Today on the Tove Podcast, I'm going to explore 13 descriptors of the Messiah using only the Tanakh. I will not name any particular person in terms of who these descriptors are referring to. I will not refer to the New Testament at any point. I will quote some people, including rabbis. I invite all listeners to engage with an open mind, knowing that I am only using the Hebrew Bible. Thanks for joining me as we discuss 13 passages about the Messiah on the Tove Podcast.
You are listening to the Tove Podcast.
Well, last week's episode caused quite a firestorm. Many people commented on the Tove Facebook page, which I'm glad to see. Many voiced their strong opinions. And a lot of these precious people were very angry. Several were especially angry that our guest on last week's show claimed to be Jewish and yet believed in Yeshua, Jesus, as the Messiah. First, I want to ask the question, why should we even look for somebody? Is the Messiah that central of a figure throughout the Tanakh? Well, I believe that he is. And one of the reasons is because I want to listen to Moses. I want to do what Moses says. And in Deuteronomy chapter 18, Moses says that there will be a prophet who will come and that we should listen to him. Specifically, Moses, of course, is telling the people of Israel that they should listen to this prophet. Moses says this in Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, quote, Adonai your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brothers. To him you must listen. Verse 16 says, This is just what you asked of Adonai your God in Horeb, or Sinai, on the day of the assembly when saying, I cannot continue to hear the voice of Adonai my God, or see his great fire anymore, or I will die. End quote. We see two things here from Moses. Number one, we see that God will raise this person up. This person would come from their midst, from your brothers. In other words, this is going to be God's doing, and he's going to raise up this person from the Jewish people, from the brothers. But what's really key about this passage is that Moses says, to him you must listen. Now, obviously, we want to do what Moses tells us to do. And at the very end of the Torah, we see that the writer of the Torah specifically tells us that to this day, no prophet has arisen like that of Moses who knew God face to face. In other words, readers of the Torah are to keep looking for this prophet whom Moses spoke about. And that's what we want to do today. Without further ado, the first descriptor of the Messiah that we want to look at today comes from the book of Genesis written by Moses, chapter 49, verse 10. In this particular passage, we learn that the Messiah will descend from specifically the tribe of Judah. And Judah would hold power until this messianic figure comes. Quote, the scepter, or the power, will not pass from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. To him will be the obedience of the peoples. Now here in this passage, it is implied that there will be a transfer of the right to rule. When Messiah comes, the lawmaking power from Judah's ranks, which is later known as the Sanhedrin, will yield to a higher power. Now, as Jewish author Louis Goldberg says, we must carefully note the time of this prophecy, however. It is true that groups of scholars have brought together beliefs and traditions and put their traditions into written form so that they are authoritative. But this is not lawgiving in the same sense that the Sanhedrin was a lawgiver in the ranks of the nation. We need to look for the time that Judah still had a scepter of rulership over a unified people when there was also a Sanhedrin, and we must look for the point in time when there was the shift of authority. This change took place in the Jewish Commonwealth only in the first century. In other words, author Louis Goldberg is making the point here that the scepter continued to be with Judah until the first century, when the temple was destroyed. And what Genesis 49:10 tells us is that the scepter will not depart from Judah until he to whom it belongs will come. So, knowing that today the scepter is not with Judah, we must ask ourselves, did somebody come before 70 AD? Because apparently, he had to in order for the scepter to be removed. This brings us to Numbers chapter 24, verses 17 through 19. What we see here is that this future Messiah figure will be born of the seed of Jacob and will restore Israel by conquering her end-of-days enemies. Quote, I see him, yet not at this moment. I behold him, yet not in this location. For a star will come from Jacob. A scepter will arise from Israel. He will crush the foreheads of Moab and the skulls of all the sons of Seth. Edom will be conquered, his enemies will conquer Seir, but Israel will triumph. One from Jacob will rule and destroy the city's survivors. Now here, it's clear that the Messiah is in view. In fact, this is the view of the ancient Targumim, the Midrash Rabbah, Devarim 1:20. And something I'd like to point out about this passage is that it's clear this future Messiah will be from Jacob, a.k.a. Israel. There have been many messianic figures down through the centuries, but if you ever come across someone claiming to be the Messiah and they are not from Israel, they are most definitely a false Messiah. This brings us to Daniel chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, which talks about the timing of Messiah's arrival. Daniel says this, So know and understand, from the issuing of the decree to restore and to build Jerusalem until the time of the Mashiach, the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be rebuilt, the plaza and moat, but it'll be in times of distress. Verse 26. Then after the 62 weeks, Mashiach will be cut off and have nothing. Then the people of a prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. But his end will come like a flood. Until the end of the war that is decreed, there will be destruction. Now the book of Daniel makes it even clearer that Messiah had to come before the destruction of the second temple. This is what we read. And after the 62 sevens, Messiah shall be cut off, and there will be nothing for him. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, this is by no means an easy text, but two things are clear. Number one, Messiah will die a violent death. Number two, his death will be followed by a new destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Of course, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed in the year 70 AD. So again, we must ask ourselves, did somebody come before the destruction of the second temple? For Daniel says that this messianic figure must come, and afterward the temple will be destroyed. Did Messiah come to his temple and die a violent death before the year 70? If the scriptures are true, he should have. This brings us to Micah chapter 5, verse 1 in the Hebrew Bible. This verse clearly states that this Messiah would be born in a specific location, that being Bethlehem. Micah chapter 5, verse 1, again in the Hebrew Bible, says this, But you, Bethlehem Ephrata, least among the clans of Judah, from you will come out to me one to be ruler in Israel, one whose goings forth are from old, from days of eternity. Now, for anybody claiming the role of Messiah, we have the right to ask and the responsibility to ask where they were born. If it's any place other than Bethlehem of the region of Ephrata, they are not the Messiah, and should be immediately rejected as such. To accept somebody as the Messiah, even if they were not born in Bethlehem, is to completely contradict what the scriptures say about the Messiah. I won't name any names, but there are a few out there who are being revered as the Messiah, and yet they weren't even born in Bethlehem. This brings us to the prophet Isaiah. In chapter 7, verse 14, we see that the Messiah would be born of a virgin. It says this, quote, "Therefore, Adonai himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin," in the Hebrew here, this is Alma, "when she is giving birth to a son, she will call his name Emmanuel." Now, there's something miraculous about this individual because it is a sign. Furthermore, this individual is designated as Emmanuel. The Messiah is God with us. The Messiah is born as a human being, and yet he's God with us. Anyone claiming to be the Messiah, and yet they were not born of a virgin, they do not have a rightful claim of being the Messiah, according to the prophet Isaiah, chapter 7, verse 14. This brings us to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 7, where we see that a divine child would be heir to the throne of David. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7 say this, "For to us a child is born, a son will be given to us, and the government will be upon his shoulder. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, My Father of Eternity, Prince of Peace." Verse 6, "Of the increase of his government and shalom there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it through justice and righteousness from now until evermore. The zeal of Adonai Tzivaot will accomplish this." Now, a couple points here I want to make about Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. Number one, there's a child born. Number two, this child is given divine titles that are only reserved of God himself elsewhere in Scripture. Number three, we see that he will sit on the throne of David and over his kingdom. This brings us to Isaiah chapter 53, verse 3, where we see that when this Messiah arrives, he'll be rejected by the majority of Israel. Isaiah chapter 53, verse 3 says this, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we did not esteem him." So what we see there is that 700 years before the Common Era, Isaiah, writing prophetically on behalf of his people, says that this messianic figure would actually be despised. This messianic figure would be rejected by men. In fact, he'd be a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and people would hide their face from him. Isaiah says he was despised, and we, Israel, did not esteem him. Fascinating. That's a picture of the Messiah that's not often upheld to most of us. It's one of a Messiah that is rejected. This brings us to a few verses later in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 7, where we see that this same messianic figure would be silent in the face of any accusations. Quote, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, like a sheep before its shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth." Now that's fascinating. We've already seen here two different pictures of the Messiah. One, back in Numbers 24, where this messianic figure who arises from Jacob would conquer Israel's end-time enemies. But now we see here this lamb led to the slaughter in Isaiah. This person that did not even open their mouth and try to stop what was happening to him. Very fascinating indeed. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the final five passages that describe the Messiah on the Tov Podcast.
Since 1887, Life in Messiah has helped Christians understand the Jewish roots of our faith and God's ongoing commitment to His people. We teach that anti-Semitism is inconsistent with biblical faith, and we pray for the peace of Jerusalem, which includes her spiritual renewal as well as physical safety. In all we do, our priority is to share the gospel message. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or at lifeinmessiah.org. That's lifeinmessiah.org.
This brings us to Isaiah chapter 53, verse 9, where we learn that this messianic figure Isaiah is referring to would be buried with the rich. Isaiah 53:9 says, "His grave was given with the wicked, and by a rich man in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth." Now, we learn a couple things from this passage. Number one, apparently, people are going to put this Messiah into a grave. Not only that, it would be the grave with the wicked, not some kind of a wonderful ceremony with the righteous. And also, he would be put by a rich man in his death. So anybody who's already died and claims to be the Messiah should have been given a grave with the wicked and should have been placed by a rich man in his death. Another point, though, is that this Messiah had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. So anybody that's lived in the past that had carried on some kind of violent reputation is disqualified for this messianic figure that Isaiah is referring to. This brings us to the very next verse, Isaiah chapter 53, verse 10. And we learn there that the Messiah would be an atonement for Israel's sins. Here's what Isaiah 53:10 says, quote, "Yet it pleased Adonai to bruise him. He caused him to suffer. If he makes his soul a guilt offering, he will see his offspring, he will prolong his days, and the will of Adonai will succeed by his hand." End quote. Here's another quote from our Jewish friend Louis Goldberg. He says this, "The word that's used here for offering in Isaiah 53:10 is asham. This is the same word that we find in Leviticus chapter 5, where it is translated trespass offering. When we examine the qualifications for the trespass offerings, we find that these offerings were to be perfect, without spot or blemish. Now, my question for you is, would you say that Israel is without spot, without blemish? Is Israel perfect? And that they could be such an offering that Isaiah is referring to? I personally don't think so. The point is, this passage does not refer to the nation of Israel. And if Isaiah 53:10 does not refer to the nation of Israel as a perfect asham, then Israel cannot be the subject of this passage. Therefore, we're driven to the conclusion that Isaiah was referring to a unique individual, the Messiah. We apply the passage, therefore, to this individual Messiah, who apparently is caused to suffer at God's will. That's what the passage says. It pleased Adonai to bruise him, and he, Adonai, caused him to suffer. And if he, Adonai, makes his soul a asham, then he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of Adonai will succeed by his hand. Wow. So whoever this individual Messiah is that had to come sometime in the first century, he should have essentially laid down his life for people at the will of God. And this particular person had to be perfect because he's referred to as an asham, criteria that Israel simply can't meet. This brings us to Isaiah 53:12. Isaiah 53:12 teaches us the following. "Therefore, I will give him a portion with the great, and he will divide the spoil with the mighty, because he poured out his soul to death and was counted with transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors." Now, what we see here in Isaiah 53:12 is that this messianic figure would be crucified alongside others who really were sinners. But this messianic figure is said to have poured out his soul to death. Again, he did this willingly. And interestingly enough, he bore the sin of many. Wow. So it seems that this messianic figure took on the sin of others. And as we learned earlier, this was an asham. This was a sacrifice of a perfect nature. Now, this brings us to Psalm 16, verse 10. We learn from Psalm 16:10 that the Messiah would rise from the grave. And we've already seen from Isaiah that this messianic figure would be placed in a grave. But now we learn that he would not stay in the grave. Psalm 16:10 says this, "For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor let your faithful one see the pit." You see, David is writing this psalm, but he's writing it prophetically, and it refers to this same messianic figure. Finally, this brings us to Psalm 22, verse 16. We learn from Psalm 22:16 that this Messiah would be pierced. Verses 16 and 17 say this, "My strength is dried up like a clay pot. My tongue clings to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of the earth. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has closed in on me. They pierced my hands and my feet." End quote. Again, author Louis Goldberg says the following about this passage. "This is a messianic psalm, and it has always been regarded as such. There is an amazing aspect proclaimed here. David wrote this psalm around 1000 BC when stoning was the method of capital punishment. Yet David was describing a manner of death which was foreign to the people of David's day. Under the influence of the Spirit of God, David spoke of Messiah's hands and feet being pierced, which depicts crucifixion. This method of execution was unknown to the culture of David's generation. The Romans were the first to practice this peculiar means of execution." End quote. Now, what we learn from Psalm 22:16 is that this Messiah, who, at God's will, would willingly lay down his life for many, would actually be pierced. It's incredible that David wrote about someone being pierced long before the method of crucifixion ever came into being. So, we've just covered 13 different aspects of the Messiah using only the Tanakh. I'd like to review just so we can get a handle on this. Number one, we answered the question, why should we even be looking for somebody? The answer is, we want to listen to Moses. And Moses tells us that God is going to raise up a prophet from among the Jewish people, and we should listen to him. Next, our first characteristic we learned comes from Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, where we learn that the Messiah would be specifically descended from the tribe of Judah, and Judah was to hold on to power until the Messiah comes. And what we learned is that the lawmaking power, known as the Sanhedrin, ended in 70 AD. Therefore, the Messiah, if the scriptures are correct, had to come before 70 AD. Number two characteristic we learned is that the Messiah had to be born of the seed of Jacob. We learn this from Numbers chapter 24, verses 17 through 19, when it says, "A star will come from Jacob." Again, if someone claims to be the Messiah and they're not from Israel, they can immediately be rejected. This brings us to our third characteristic, and that is the timing of the Messiah's arrival. What we learn from Daniel chapter 9 is that the Messiah had to come before the temple was destroyed. This is clearly seen in Daniel chapter 9, verse 26, when he says that after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off or killed. And then, and only after the Messiah is cut off and killed, would the people of a prince who's to come destroy the city and the sanctuary. Of course, the sanctuary is the temple. This brings us to our fifth characteristic, and that is probably the most simple, and that is that the Messiah, according to Micah, had to be born in Bethlehem. Specifically, in Bethlehem of the region of Ephrata. And This particular Messiah would be ruler in Israel, and he's given divine attributes, such as that he exists from the days of eternity. Our sixth characteristic comes from the prophet Isaiah. And Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 tells us that he would be born of a virgin. And this would be a miraculous sign as it's presented in the text. If it's just a child who's born of a normal woman, then it's not much of a sign. But a sign that is extraordinary, that only God could produce, this is surely a sign from heaven if a virgin conceives a child. Our sixth characteristic is that this divine child that Isaiah speaks of would be heir to the throne of David and would have divine titles, such as Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Father of Eternity, and Prince of Peace. Our seventh attribute comes from Isaiah 53, verse 3, where we learn that this messianic figure would be rejected by Israel. Now, it's a popular misconception that when the Messiah comes, he'll just be welcomed by everybody. But this is actually not what the scriptures teach. Isaiah 53, 3 says that he would be rejected by Isaiah's people, and that is Israel. Our eighth characteristic comes from the same chapter, and that's that this messianic figure would be silent in the face of accusations. He would not try to lead a rebellion, claiming that this was an injustice. Rather, he would willingly be led like a lamb to the slaughter, and like a sheep before its shearers is silent, he did not open his mouth. Our ninth characteristic is that this messianic figure, after he willingly goes to his death, would be buried with the rich. We learn this from Isaiah 53, 9, when Isaiah tells us that his grave was given with the wicked and by a rich man in his death. We also learn from this passage that this messianic figure will do no violence and there will be no deceit in his mouth. The 10th passage teaches us that this perfect sacrifice would be an atonement for Israel's sins, and that indeed his sacrifice actually pleased Adonai. For the text says, he caused him to suffer, and he makes his soul an asham. This is a fascinating characteristic, that God would willingly place the punishment upon someone for the sins of somebody else. Our 11th characteristic, again by way of review, comes from Isaiah 53:12, and we learn that this messianic figure would be crucified with transgressors. In Psalm 16:10, by way of review, tells us that after this willing death, this messianic figure would rise from the grave. Hence the text, "You will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor let your faithful one see the pit." And finally, by way of review, Psalm 22:16, our 13th characteristic of the Messiah from the Tanakh, says that the Messiah would be pierced.
O come, Emmanuel.
I hope today has helped you as you seek to put a portrait together of the Messiah from the Tanakh. If you found us, that's wonderful. Feel free to go over to the Tove Facebook page and leave us a comment or a question. You can also subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or a host of other platforms. May God bless you as you continue your study of the Scriptures.
And a ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel. Shall come to thee, O Israel.